I don't do like a visual storyboard, like drawing or anything like that, but I always make a shot list. So it's more of a mental storyboard that I just write down in text version, like what the shots are that I want to get as I'm thinking through every step of that recipe. And you always want to censor yourself. You don't need a shot of literally every action. You really want to just think about the stuff that's the most visually interesting, that looks the best.
This is your host, Dyutima, but you can call me DJ. And I love to inspire food photographers to dream. I spent 15 years as an architect studying buildings and constructing hospitals before taking the biggest leap of faith of my life, which was setting up a food styling and food photography business right from scratch. If you're a dreamer like me, wanting to start a new photography business, or grow your existing food photography business, jump right into a world where I share practical, actionable strategies to improve your photography skills, to work with clients, make more money, or with a fearless mindset. This is the My Food Lens podcast, and we take you one step closer to your dreams. So let's go. Welcome to another episode of the My Food Lens podcast. And today, you better be as excited as I am, because today we have an icon from the food photography industry who's joining us for a smashing, hot, flaming, amazing conversation on a topic that we absolutely love. So our guest today is Eva Cosmas Flores. I mean, we all know her so well. But if you're not familiar, Eva is a food photographer. She's an author. She's a videographer. She's an educator. She's based in Portland, Oregon. And she actually teaches videography and photography through her online courses and in-person workshops. So I'm pretty sure that you've seen her beautiful work on social media and maybe even come across her two cookbooks that she's written on seasonal eating. So Eva is a master at videos, and today she is going to share with us everything from technical to business to pricing about food videography. We all know how popular food videos have become, how much the demand has gone up. And Eva has been doing this not for 1 year, 2 years. She's been doing this from the beginning of time, from the beginning of her career, for over 10 years. So you can understand what a wealth of knowledge she is on this topic. And so I can't wait to invite her. Let's get started. All right, let's go. Hi, Eva, and welcome to My Food Lens podcast. Oh my God, I am literally shaking in my chair right now, seeing you in front of me. What an absolute delight. What an absolute honor to have you on our podcast.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm just so happy to be here and so excited to chat with you. And I know we're going to have a lot of fun chatting about video. So yeah, very excited.
I have no doubt about it. In fact, Eva, I think you should know that, you have been a part of my world ever since I've been in food photography. So, I started food photography like maybe a little bit over 5 years ago, and you were an icon in the industry at that time, and you still are. And so you can imagine what an honor it is, to have you here, really. It's to have you here, to have you on our show, to have you talking to us. It's a big deal. So welcome, and thank you so much for making the time.
Yeah, of course. Thank you. You're so sweet.
So I know that we're going to talk about food videos, and I also know that that is something that you're so good at. Like, there are very few people in the industry who do it as well and as uniquely as you do. But before that, I just want to shake it out, get some energy, and just start us with something really, really fun. So we would love for you to share something fun about yourself that we might not know.
Yeah, I was like, well, maybe I'll share that I'm a knitter, but I feel like I'm pretty public about that. Like, let me think of something that's a little bit like more unknown and strange, I guess. I really love horror movies and suspense movies. It's like my favorite genre. I'm obsessed. And which I think is a little funny because all my photos, well, there's like a moody element, but you know, they tend to be a little cheerful. They're not like dark or anything in terms of like scariness or anything like that. But I guess that's something kind of fun and silly that people probably wouldn't expect.
And very brave. I have never watched a horror movie. I've always watched a horror movie from under the bed, literally, or under my cushion. I can't,
Oh
no, it is my,
God. I
it is so tough. So you
love
are brave. I love it. Very few people do that, by the way. So
that.
amazing. So tell us, Eva, we're going to start getting into our videography conversation. I know that food videos are so hot right now, and
Yes.
everybody's interested. All the clients are like grooving. It's just, so hot on social media. But when you started, things were a lot different. So tell us a little bit about what made you create your first video,
Yes.
and what was the challenge at that time?
Yeah, that's such a fun question because this is going to take us way back because in 2009. So my college degree is in video, basically. So my first video I made back then, as a part of a college class. So that was a mix of stop motion animation and live, like normal shooting with like some people. And then I did like stop motion animation with radishes. It was just like a really silly, funny little student film that I did. And I think I edited it on like the very first version of Final Cut Pro because it had like just come out at the time. It's like, wow, we can edit on the computer now. This is great. So yeah, that was the very first video that I remember making was way back in like 2009. So
And
while
that was for
back.
your when you were in college, when you were
When
getting
I
your
was in
degree.
college, yeah.
Wow, that explains so much about, how you make it look so effortless, but it's also because it's something that's part of you. That's how
Yeah.
you're part of your education, your background. Wow, I had no idea about this. So that's amazing. And you said that you started off like with the first version of some of the applications. But when you really went into the professional world, or when you got out of college, what was the gear that you were using at that time, and how has that evolved now?
Yeah, so when I started doing more food photography, like types of things, and I started like first just doing photography, and then I started actually using my video training to do food videos. I think I was using the Canon 5D Mark III was when I first started doing videos with food for like Instagram or for my blog, especially. It wasn't even so much for Instagram because there was a period where you couldn't even really post videos on Instagram. And so I just did it for my blog because sometimes, when you have a recipe that's more complex, especially with baking, it's easier to show how to like do it and stuff. So that was kind of my intent. But the Canon 5D Mark III had really limited video settings for slow motion. So there was like not as much of a range of frame rates that you could use. And so you could only shoot mild slow motion at standard definition, which is a little bit lower. It's below high definition, so that's not great because ideally you'd want it to be like in HD. And so that's kind of what I started with. But then from there, I upgraded to the Canon 5D Mark IV, which had better video settings for sure at the time. So I could shoot in like moderate slow motion and more of like an extreme slow motion. So for like frame rates, it would be like I could shoot at 60 frames per second, but I could also shoot at 120 frames per second, which is like super like romantic slow. If you ever see those like really show like a slow like powdered sugar dusting, it's like that, like just very dreamy. But there were still like limitations with that. So if I wanted to shoot in really slow motion at 120 frames per second, I could do it in HD, but I couldn't do it in 4K. And I really wanted to be able to do it in 4K. And so that's why in 2022, I got the Canon R5, which is the mirrorless camera that Canon has that's like so good for video. So now I can do like all the things at 4K, which is very nice because everything's just like very high quality. And if I want to zoom in when I'm editing, I can, and I won't lose quality because I have a little bit more leeway. So yeah, that's the gear situation.
Yeah, and what I'm obviously hearing all the technical details, all the camera brands, I'm hearing of, you know, everything. But what I'm really hearing here is that your style evolved, and that's how your requirements evolved, and that's how your investment went. So you knew what you were looking for at every different stage. You were like, oh, I want to make this. I want to create this. This one does it better. So I'm going to put my money there. And that's what I'm hearing. Yeah. Like, that's such a great tip for our listeners, you know, that you don't just go and buy the most expensive or the one that your favorite photographer has. You go and buy what you need based on what you want to create. Yes. So I love that.
I think that's such a good point too, because like, I feel like sometimes people want to put the cart before the horse and like buy the thing before they like learn anything about it. And I think it's actually really good to play around with like whatever gear you have, just like play around with video, because then when you are like, okay, now I really do want to get like a video camera, you know what you're looking for, so you can make a much smarter purchasing decision and not waste your money on maybe things that sounded cool at the time, but you're like, actually, I don't really need that. And I think that's such a good point.
Just on that point itself, you know, there's this whole rage around mirrorless cameras. And one of the biggest selling points of these mirrorless cameras is that they're great for videos. So what's your take on it? Mirrorless versus DSLRs? What are your thoughts?
Yeah, this is a really good question. So mirrorless cameras are a newer iteration of a digital camera. So they are going to have like the newest technology incorporated into them for video simply because they are the newer camera, but not necessarily that it being mirrorless and having no mirror that flips up means it's better for video. Like that doesn't necessarily correspond to a better video. It's just that because the mirrorless ones are like the newer thing, they have the really good new technology with like the better sensors and, you know, just better video specs. Cause now you can like my R5 can shoot up to 8K, which is crazy for a camera that's like that small.
Yeah.
It's like really, really high resolution. Cause when I was in school, the cameras that shot like that, you know, they were these massive things that you would use on like movie sets. So it's like, that's insane to me. But you know, like within both camera types, there's definitely a range of specs depending on your budget. So like, you could use a more expensive DSLR and you're going to be able to shoot a lot better video than you would with like a cheap mirrorless camera, and vice versa. So I would definitely, if you know, if you're looking to get into video and you're like, I do want to get a camera that's more video friendly, I would really look at the specs of like the resolution that it shoots at and the frame rates that it's able to shoot at and the sensor size. Those are like the big three things that I would be more concerned with than rather than if it is mirrorless or if it is a DSLR camera.
Wow. That's such a great tip, because again, everybody's just like mirrorless. It's that, you know, shiny new object. Everyone's just chasing it. I'm guilty as well. I got myself one and I just realized that I keep going back to my DSLR. I have, you know, I switch between them and they both have their place, but I'm yet to find that real, real, you know, differentiator, except for the weight and the size.
Yeah.
You know, the mirrorless is kind of equivalent for me. So such a great tip. Tell me one thing, Eva, you always talk about cinematic videos and, you know, that romantic video style. It's such a signature of yours. But a lot of people in the community really don't know what is a cinematic video and what is a food video and what is a normal video. Like, what is it? Tell us.
To me, a cinematic video is a video that intentionally combines the technical settings of the camera with the artistic display of the materials that are inside your frame. So like thoughtful styling and things like that. So you're combining those two to invoke emotion and feeling in the viewer. So it's not like a copy paste style format that's super casual and shot on like a phone and just like boom, 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 boom. Here's the steps for all from the same shot and the same angle. It is more thought out. It's more creative. And it really shows like the vision and the voice of the creator And you really want to take your viewer on some sort of emotional journey. And that could be funny. It could be like nostalgic. It could be comforting. It could even be hungry. If you, you know, with food videos, you want them to feel like comforted, but hungry a lot of the time too. And I also just want to preface that to also say, or maybe I'd like more of a footnote than a preface. That doesn't mean that the like really simple educational ones shot on the phone are better. Like, I don't think any type is better than the other. I think they are both very effective in different ways. And it just all depends on you as a creator and like what your intent is and what you're comfortable with. Cinematic video, that's like what it means for me.
Mm-hmm. So it has a big element of storytelling in it. And there's a lot. So when I started learning about cinematic videos, the one thing that stuck in my head was that it's like a movie. In a movie, you're not just seeing one thing, one angle, one, you know, it's dynamic, it's moving. And it's telling you, it's taking you through that journey, the experience, that story. So, you know, and so that's how we translate it into food videos. They might be shorter, but that doesn't mean that they wouldn't have that story. So that is so powerful because, you know, as food photographers, it's sometimes hard to convey that story in that one shot. But as a food video, you can definitely take your viewer on that journey, you know? So I love that. For anyone who's listening to this for the first time, it might sound like a lot of work and it might sound maybe a bit overwhelming. I don't know. So maybe let's just break it down a little bit for them. So how do you start? Whether it's your personal project or it's a client project, do you create a storyboard? Or how do you come up with a concept which is time efficient and at the same time really keeps your process streamlined?
Yeah, definitely. I don't do like a visual storyboard, you know, like drawing or anything like that, but I always make a shot list. So it's more of a mental storyboard that I just write down in text version, like what the shots are that I want to get as I'm thinking through every step of that recipe. And you always want to censor yourself. You don't need a shot of literally every action. You really want to just think about the stuff that's the most visually interesting, that looks the best. So like, for example, if I was making a cake and I'm adding like sugar and flour and baking soda and cinnamon, I don't need to show everything going in. Maybe I just get one shot of me sifting flour in like a really pretty S curve slowly down. And that's it. That's all I need for that step. And now we can skip ahead to the eggs cracking and falling. Cause like, that's kind of cool to look at too, especially if you slow it down. So trying not to get caught up on like, I have to show every detail, but more thinking about what are the most visually interesting details that I could show from this recipe. And yeah, that's definitely my process. I always make a shot list before video shoot. Otherwise, it's just going to take so long because you're kind of like overshooting, you know? You're like, oh, I guess I should get this just in case. Or I guess I should get this just in case because you haven't actually thought about it. And then you spend so much time setting up all these shots that, you know, most of us are creating for Instagram. We only have 60 seconds max. Yeah. And most people stop watching after the first 8 seconds. So it's like, you don't even need to make it that long, honestly. So you do all this extra work that you don't need to do because it won't even make it in the video. So that's why I think the shot list is like so key because it just helps you make sure you're making like the best use of your time when you're actually shooting and editing too.
And do you usually create mostly for Instagram or are you also creating for other purposes and especially for clients? The reason I'm asking this is just to know that are you usually creating 60-second videos or longer?
No, they're usually 60 seconds or less. And they are for myself, for Instagram, and for brands. But for the brands, it's usually also for Instagram too. Like they want to be able to post it on Instagram. So it still needs to meet the Instagram criteria of like duration. And, you know, they tend to want like faster cuts because it helps progress the story along. But I have also shot stuff for other platforms. Like I also shot one last year for an Amazon listing, which was new. So that was like a horizontal oriented video. Normally I do vertical for Instagram, but this was a product. that I needed to make a little video of. So that was like fun and a little bit different, but yeah.
Mm-hmm. Short form, different orientations. It could be anything, but basically you have to create a short list or a storyboard to capture the most interesting parts. So don't get drawn into everything, all your life's work. Just focus on what's most important. You know, what's interesting, what you said is how you write down everything and it's written in words, step by step. I'm the exact opposite. It's so crazy how every creator has their own system. So I'm an arch. I used to be an architect, right? So everything for me is very, very awesome. Visual. And even if I need to think of words, I will create a box. I will create some visuals and then I'll put my words. So I even storyboard my words when I need to write captions or things like that. Everything for me is within a visual and that's how I execute. But yours is so different. And I feel like, you know, people just need to understand what's their most efficient way, what's something that truly relates to them, their style. Just because you put it as a short list doesn't mean they have to. Maybe they want to draw pictures and that's okay.
Yeah, 100%. Whatever's going to work for you to help you like get some sort of sense of organization in place. Also, I feel like it takes the stress off too when you're on set that way because you're not like scrambling to come up with ideas. Like you've already taken some time and it doesn't take that long, like 20 minutes to just sit and think about what do I want for this shoot? And, you know, putting it somewhere you can reference it, whether it's a drawing or words, it's just going to, I think, make you have more fun when you're on set and just make it easier and less stressful too.
And focus your energy on where it really needs to be. But tell me one thing, Eva. So once you've created those, you know, your shot list, at what point do you have that visual story in your mind where you are taking decisions about color theme, mood, props, backdrops? I'm sure you have something in mind before you start shooting. So at what stage are you deciding on those things?
Thinking about color mainly, that's like such a jump. Color and the main ingredients are like the biggest jumping off point for what informs pretty much everything else. So I'll start just kind of thinking about visually, like what I want stylistically, like, do I want it to be bright and cheerful? Do I want it to be dark and moody? What colors do I want to use? What surface? And I know my surfaces pretty well. Which one do I think would look cool for this? Thinking about the props I have. And I'll also make notes about that on the shot list too, just so that when I'm on set, I can look and be like, what surface was the thing for this again? Oh yeah, like this one, I'll go pull it and see how it looks in frame. And sometimes it doesn't look good in frame and then you have to try a different surface that happens too. Mm-hmm. But I would say that that's probably the very first thing that I think about. Then I write the shot list, thinking about the visuals of how everything's going to look in mind. And on the shot list, I also try to put framing too. So like not just the action of what's happening, but like, do I want it to be a really big close-up shot? Or do I want it to be like a wider shot where we see like the table and the chair? Mm. You know, those type of notes I'll put on the shot list too, so that I'm making sure that I'm shooting stuff that also changes the angle and the composition. So, you know, like you were talking about something that looks dynamic, you know, it keeps changing. So it looks interesting. It keeps the viewer engaged. So I'll make little notes about that on the shot list too.
Now that's part of the cinematicness, I guess.
Yes.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. All right. So tell us, Eva, what about the applications? Like in my mind, when I think of editing a food video, I faint. I pass out. So it's just the overwhelm of the technology, you know? Really. What applications would you suggest that food photographers can get started with, especially for editing?
I think if you have never edited a video before, I think if you want to start on your smartphone, there's two options that are really good. There's the Adobe Rush mobile app from the Adobe Creative Suite. It's great. And I go over that in my vertical video course. I think I do. Yeah, there's like a mobile video editing tutorial of that app. And then there's another app that I really like too, called the VN mobile editing app. So it's V as in Victor, N as in Nancy. And the thing that's really cool about the VN mobile editing app is you can install LUTs on that mobile app. and LUTs are video presets. So you can just quickly apply a LUT to your video and kind of have a quick color grade to it without having to do it yourself. So I also like make and sell LUTs too. And it's really nice that there is one video editing app that's mobile that accepts LUTs, because that's like the only one that I'm aware of. Most of them don't let you put LUTs in the app. So that one's pretty cool. And then for desktop, if you're like, okay, well, I want to sit on my computer and edit, I would say Adobe Rush again. The desktop version is also really good for when you're starting out. It's just pretty simple and really straightforward. If you've ever even like played around with editing in iMovie before, it's kind of a similar layout to that, but with more professional options. And I think, you know, if you're already in the Creative Cloud, you might have access to it unless you're only a Lightroom subscriber. But if you have like the full Creative Cloud, then you could definitely just download Rush and start playing around with it.
Wow. And do you edit most of your videos on the phone or on the desktop?
I edit them on the desktop, and I use a program called DaVinci Resolve, which I love, and it is definitely more advanced. So I would say that one is advanced, and then Adobe Premiere is advanced as well. So if you're like, I've played with Adobe Rush, I'm ready to try something more challenging and have even more control over all the edits and have advanced features, those are the two apps I would for sure recommend. And DaVinci Resolve, I just really like the workflow. It's pretty visually based, whereas I feel like Adobe Premiere can be a little bit more menu based. There's like a lot of little menu windows that can be a little overwhelming sometimes. So I just kind of like the layout of DaVinci Resolve. I bet you would probably like it too as a really visual person. It's just like everything's kind of like just all there. And I go over both of those in my video course too, but I love DaVinci Resolve. That's my favorite. That's what I use.
That's where you've, after all these years of creating videos, you've come to this one, which is like, ah, amazing.
Yeah, I found my forever friend. But I will also say the cool thing about DaVinci Resolve is it's totally free. So you don't have to buy it. You can download it for free from the website, which is pretty cool. Yeah.
Wow, that is rare. To find something good and free is rare. So fantastic. I'm sure that a lot of our listeners are going to be on it. Yeah. I want to ask you one more technical question before we switch into all the business and the creative conversation. So tell us a little bit about frame rate, Eva. A lot of folks might be confused about what might be, you know, the kind of frame rates for slow, for fast, what's a mistake, what to avoid. Just some general tips and guidelines for choosing frame rates for our videos.
Yes, this is such a good question, because I think it's the most confusing thing that people get bogged down by a lot. So when you're choosing your frame rate, you are making that decision based off of how you want the motion to look in the finished video. So each of the four like main frame rate settings I'm going to go over, they each have their own kind of like look. So I'll kind of go through and explain each one and what it looks like. So there's 24 frames per second, which is what the setting is in the US. But if you have a non-US camera, it might say 25 frames per second. So that frame rate is more of a cinematic normal movement. So like, if you go to the movies and like to the movie theater and you're watching a movie, it's like it is normal movement. It's not crazy slow motion, but there's some level of like smoothness and elegance to it, I would say. Then we go up to 30 frames per second is the next frame rate setting that you usually have on your camera. And that's more crisp, normal movement. So like if you're watching the news or if you're watching reality TV, it's just a little bit crisper and sharper. It doesn't have like that like soft smoothness that like a fancy movie would have. Now we're going to get into slow-mo territory, and not every make and model of camera will have these options. Typically, the more high grade or expensive the camera is, the more slow-mo options you have. So if you're like, I don't even have these, it's probably just your camera might be older or just doesn't have that capability. But so the next one you're likely to see is 60 frames per second if you're in the US. If you're outside the US, it's probably going to say 50 frames per second, 50. And so that's moderate slow motion. So that is slow, but not like crazy slow. So if we're thinking about, you know, numbers, doing some math. 30 frames per second is like normal crisp movement. So if we're thinking about it, 60 frames per second would pretty much be twice as slow as like how things appear in real life. So slower, but not insanely slower. And then the other option you might have for your frame rate is really slow motion. And that is 120 frames per second in the US, or if you're outside the US, it'll probably be 100 or maybe even 110 frames per second. And so that's pretty slow. That is like four times slower than how things would appear in real life. And that is going to take up a lot more space on your memory card, the higher your frame rate is. So that's something to keep in mind as well, because you're capturing four times the length of footage because everything slowed down. So if you start shooting in slow motion, just be aware you're going to be filling up your card a lot faster. And it's going to take up, of course, more space on your external hard drive once you start downloading all your cards and stuff too. So like I used to have a 2 terabyte hard drive that would last me all year before I started doing video, and I was like just doing stills. And now my 2 terabyte hard drives will get me about 3 or 4 months because of how much they saw the video files take up. So just something to be aware of. But that's pretty much what the frame rate is it's really how do you want the motion to look in the finished video? And that's what's going to inform the frame rate decision that you make.
So when you create your shot list and you have that kind of vision that I want this to be slow, I want this to look romantic, I want this to be really peppy, energetic, and I want this to move fast, do you kind of make a note of your frame rates as well? In the shot list?
Yes.
You do?
Yes. Yeah, okay. That's such a good question. Yes, I do. Yeah, because I'm thinking about really mentally visualizing, like, what do I want it to look like? And so if I'm like, this will look really good, super slowed down, then I'll put that. Or to the opposite, like your example, if it was like a chopping shot and I'm like for like a knife client and they want these like sexy, really fast, like, you know, knives chopping onions or whatever, then maybe I would do like 30 frames per second or maybe 24 to give it like a more cinematic, smooth look. But no, like normal speed, right? Not super, super slowed down. So,
It looks like you really spend the time in creating the shot list. It's really well thought out. It's got enough information for you to start at a really well-informed place when you begin shooting. So that time that you put up front, I'm sure it increases your efficiency. You're able to use your energy in the right and creative places during the shoot. Are there any other like one or two tips that you can just share that can make videography just a bit more efficient? People can save more time. Just any such tips that you can share?
Yeah, definitely. I would say try to prepare as much as you can the night before for the day of shooting so that the day of shooting, you're not stuck on like all this nitty gritty manual labor, like moving stuff around, bringing out your gear, prepping ingredients that you probably could have prepped last night and like kept in the fridge. Like that kind of, for me, slows down my creative like juices when I get stuck on those kind of more boring, monotonous things. Cause the day of the shoot, I usually just want to like, okay, like I'm ready to create something. Like I just want to go and like dive in. So I feel like if you can do a little bit of prep work the day before, it's going to just get you into the creative zone, like that flow state a lot more easily. The shot list helps with that too, because again, it's also about just eliminating stress, I think, and making sure that once you're shooting, you know, everything's going smoothly. You don't have to worry about like chopping the onion, you know, like stop shooting, I have to chop my onion or whatever. It's like, well, I chopped yesterday, it's already in like my little Tupperware, so I can just pull it out and keep going and keep rolling. So I think prepping is super duper helpful. I also think that afterwards, when you are editing, something that can take up a lot of time is not being organized with your footage can really bite you later. So I think having a really good storage system in place, you know, for like being organized about where all your footage is and what knowing what hard drive it's on, that's going to help save you a lot of time when you're editing your video too.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. That's such a great one. I'm a huge believer in prepping the night before as well. And especially I feel like food bloggers and recipe developers, they have so much more work to do. And just having all of that energy consuming effort done the night before leaves you like nicely bummed, get a cup of coffee, start shooting, feel creative, you know? So because I know that when I'm tired, I take shortcuts. And so, you know, it's so bound to happen. So this is, I love these tips. So, all right, now I'm like shifting gears now, Eva, and I want to get into, you know, we know so much about how to shoot videos and gear and all the technical stuff. But really, once we have that knowledge and we are out in the market, how do we make it into something real? Where do the other skills, you know, kick in? When do they kick in? The business skills, the legal skills, the marketing skills, all of those skills, they have to combine with these technical skills to really make it, you know, something holistic. So I'm going to shift gears now and ask you just to begin with, there's so much that goes into creating food videos. Do you usually have a team that assists you? Do you have people who would, you know, maybe help you with editing or any kind of thing? Or is it like you yourself taking it from A to Z?
It is me taking it from A to Z. I have a part-time assistant that helps me with like admin work and managing some emails. But when it comes to the actual creative side of things, I tend to work solo for most projects, personal and for clients. The exception would be if I'm like shooting on location and there's like a lot of gear that I need to bring in, like, you know, artificial lights and like all sorts of stuff. It's helpful to have an assistant to help with, you know, setting up things. Or if it's like a really, really big project, like some certain client cookbooks, if it's like we have one, the first cookbook I shot for a client, my friend Derek Sarno, we had 10 days to shoot 100 recipes. And it was like in a row every day we were working. And so I definitely had an assistant on that cookbook shoot, my friend Sasha Swerdlov, because we had so much to style and plate and change the surface quickly. And like, oh, what, prep the ceramics for the next scene. Like we, you know, we were just like flying through it. So I think it just depends on the shoot. But I would say like 95% of the time, it's just me, which is fine. You know, it's fun. I have fun.
But also you have help for something that can be, you know, handed off to someone else to execute. Some of these videos and all, they really need that creative eye. They need to have that vision taken all the way through, and handing it off to someone else doesn't always guarantee that. So I see that. But tell me how, you know, you've been into videos for so long. Do you think that, you know, shooting videos, doing photography and videography or only videography can actually help photographers to or creators to differentiate themselves in the market? There's so much competition. Do you think this could be something that becomes their unique selling point?
This is a really good question. I think that you are absolutely correct. It's a huge unique selling point and definitely a one up on everyone else because it is a really crowded market for sure. I think a lot of us got into it over COVID. And so the food photography community, I think in terms of like getting client work, it's the most competitive I've ever seen it at this current moment. So if you are looking to get something that will kind of give you one up on everyone else or give you that little extra offering to like get the client to buy in and make it an easy yes, I think being able to add video to the photography package is a huge win because video is everywhere. Like when we look at Instagram now, for me, like over half my feed is video. And, you know, any marketing statistic, if you look up marketing statistics about video, it's like all marketers, all businesses and brands are wanting more video and using more video to sell their products. So, you know, they used to be hiring photographers to take pictures to sell their products, but now they need to hire videographers to make videos to sell their products because that's where the market is going. That's where social media is going.
Right.
And so I think it's just such a smart move for your own financial future to invest in this skill set. And what I have found to be so helpful is just doing photo and video packages together because the client gets some great stills that they could use, you know, for whatever normal still stuff they would always use it for, like their website, social media, et cetera. But now they have this video that they can use for social. They could also put it on their website if they want. A lot of times I'll also try to cut like a longer and maybe a shorter version from the exact same videos so that they can use it in different platforms in different ways. Like maybe there's like a fun 10-second one, and then I do more, maybe like a longer, more detailed, like 60-second one that they're going to put on their website that like really dives into it or whatever. So I just feel like it's such a great way to up your offering and get clients to make it an easy yes.
Yeah, absolutely. I have a question on that. When you do have stills and videos, you know, for the same client and it's for the same recipe, do you create stills? Like, again, I'm talking about time efficiency. I'm just thinking of what your flow is, workflow is. So how do you create the stills? Are there kind of visuals, stills of the settings that you create for your videos, or you do your stills separately and they are a different setup and a completely different composition, and you dedicate a separate time only to do your stills? So that was part one of our conversation with Eva, and boy, wasn't that just like a crash course in food videography? You know, right from learning about cameras to frame rates, gear, just, you know, understanding when and how to put up those videos. Wow. What a powerful conversation. I hope, you know, it's gotten you a bit pumped. If you're not creating videos yet, I hope it's gotten you really, really pumped about creating videos. And it's also kind of, you know, made you understand that it's not as difficult as we think. I mean, the more we do it, the better we get at it. And it's just about a few technical details and they become second nature as we keep on practicing. So I hope it's been helpful so far. We are going to continue our conversation with Eva in part two, and that's when things will get hot and fiery. We're going to get into pricing. We're going to get into license, copyright, pitching, talking to clients, marketing, and just generally seeing the future of food videos and how you can grow and scale your business through this powerful, powerful skill. No one better than Eva to tell us all about it. So stay tuned for part two. But in the interim, if you have any questions, you know where to find me. You can email me at hello@myfoodlens.com or DM me on Instagram at @Dithima_myfoodlens. I'll see you next week with another episode. Until then, bye-bye.